The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to Tech Weekly from The Guardian. I'm Alex Kratosky. On this week's podcast, the latest digital regulations from the European Commission will be revealed. I speak with the Digital Affairs Office at the Commission to find out the latest information on the stipulations and guidelines for transparency, net neutrality, citizens' rights, and data privacy, and how these will affect consumers and businesses here in the UK. I'm joined this week in the studio by technology editor Charles Arthur. Welcome, Charles.
Hello.
Also on this week's podcast, Charles grills Microsoft's Ashley Highfield about Windows Phone 7 and the company's strategic future for mobile. Central to their new direction is Mango, the new operating system update, which will integrate social features across all of Microsoft's library of properties, including Facebook, MSN, and AOL Messenger, plus their own version of music recognition service Shazam, and their own versions of Google Maps and Google Goggles. All this plus the latest news from the technology sphere over the next 30 minutes of Tech Weekly from The Guardian. A few weeks ago on Tech Weekly, we covered the partnership between handset manufacturer Nokia and Microsoft's Windows Mobile 7 operating system, signaling a new direction for Microsoft in this space. Now, since that announcement, they've revealed the features of their next update, codenamed Mango, which will draw together many of their existing library of properties, including Facebook and MSN. Charles Arthur spoke with the man in charge, Ashley Highfield, the managing director of consumer and online for Microsoft UK. He began by asking him why Windows Phone 7 hasn't taken off in the way that was expected.
I think it's doing extremely well. It has proven to be, by a number of surveys and consumer satisfaction, an incredibly popular phone. Incredibly low return rates, incredibly high satisfaction. We went out to make a new distinctive phone that really didn't try to be a Me Too phone, and it is a really popular phone. We've hit the reset button, we're starting again, and I'm very happy with where we are at the moment.
Gartner reckons that in the first quarter, that is the last quarter of 2010, about 700,000 handsets were sold. In the first quarter of this year, about 1.6 million were sold worldwide. Is that satisfactory?
Well, those are figures that they have published. We have not given our own numbers out. And I don't want to get drawn into this being a numbers game. We are happy with the progress we're making. We are seeing a really good growth in the number of Windows phones. And we believe that with the launch of Mango, some 500 new features of the phone, that the things that have proven really popular with our customers, the people are bringing together all of your Outlook and your Facebook. And now we've added into that Twitter and LinkedIn to create a single experience of what all of your friends are up to. It's these kind of unique features of the Windows phone that we're really improving. And we think we've got a really distinctive offering.
The Mango announcement that's being made this month in May is for a product which is not coming out, you say, until autumn. Why announce it so far ahead?
Well, two reasons. One, we wanted to get the developer community really excited about all the new things that they can create and the way that apps can really integrate into the phone and some of the new features. So get it out early, get the developers engaged so we get a bunch of new apps ready for the autumn launch. And the second really is that we're very keen to show the direction of travel, the fact that we are building a really integrated communication set of services into the phone to show really the consumers there is a different kind of phone out there. We have now got a feature where if you start a communication on your phone with text and then somebody logs on to Facebook chat, you can switch and you can still be using text on your end on the phone and they can be replying using Facebook chat, or they can be using Instant Messenger, and you can switch from communication tool to communication tool. Our philosophy is it is less about the products and the apps you use and more about having a seamless one-to-one conversation with the people you want to keep in touch with. And I suppose what we want to do is to talk more about our direction of travel, our strategy, and why our phone, we believe, is very distinctive.
I listened back to the podcast that we did when Windows Phone was announced, and we were all very impressed by it. Stephen Fry was very impressed by it. Why do you think the consumers haven't heard that?
I think the consumers have heard that. I think the consumers are reading in Stuff and T3 and Wired magazine, you know, a lot of accolades for our phone. And with the current marketing campaign out there, people are getting the message, and it is working. We are getting great reviews, great traction, and we believe we've got a winning phone. And share in this marketplace will follow.
The share's probably naturally going to follow when your tie-up with Nokia becomes completed, when they start selling Windows Phone devices as their smartphones. What effect do you think that is going to have on market shares for operating system in the smartphone market?
Well, we're not making any predictions about the exact share, but certainly the relationship with Nokia is a major component of our strategy. And when we expect to start seeing volume Nokia shipments in the new year, yeah, we expect to accelerate the amount of share that we're taking in the smartphone and overall in the phone market in the UK.
Any forecasts beyond that? I'm quite astonished by how non-specific you are about all of this. Whenever we meet, you have no numbers, and when we meet after that, you still have no numbers.
Well, we do have some numbers. We have talked about the fact that we now have 16,000 apps, that we're getting 100 apps a day launched, that we believe that we have the combination of a beautiful UI, integrated apps into the core service on the phone. And as I said, because we are a new entrant into the marketplace effectively from last autumn, and the relationship with Nokia is not yet bedded in, and we're not yet seeing the new phones, but we're very excited about that. We're not talking numbers, but we are, you know, in here for the long run. We do expect to take a sizable share of the smartphone market in the UK.
That was Microsoft's Ashley Highfield. Now, Charles, how much of this announcement about Mango is big news, and how much is it really a strategic announcement in terms of marketing to make sure that they stay afloat in the wake of, you know, there's the forthcoming iOS 5 update that's expected to be announced soon. Recently, there were some Android updates that were announced, the other phone updates. I mean, how much really is this just part of their kind of PR strategy?
It's very much about PR strategy, but the thing is that this is what Nokia is going to be using once it starts shipping Windows Phone. Probably only one device seems to be the sort of indications we're getting from people, and that after October or, you know, October afterwards. So you're not going to be seeing this for months. It's all very much talking it up, and I think the feeling is to sort of say, "Hey, we're still here," you know. Don't forget about us. We're still actually around.
Where does this sit, though, the announcements for the features that are coming up, which are actually quite interesting in terms of the integration with all these different systems that they happen to own? That was quite a clever cache that they managed to acquire. With regards to the other carriers and the other features that have been announced?
Well, it's hard to know compared to Apple's iOS 5 because we don't know what that is going to have. That we're expecting to see, I think, at the Worldwide Developers Conference in the beginning of June. Compared to Android, I thought that the demonstration that I saw, the notification system, I still think Android beats everyone else hands down on that in terms of telling you, hey, this has happened. You know, you've got email here, you've got a calendar thing coming up. I think it still wins. The thing that he described in there about where you can be having a conversation with someone and it switches between the different modes of communication, yeah, that's quite neat. I question a bit the extent to which you'll really know that you're doing it. And, you know, are you going to be thinking, okay, now I'm going from text messaging, I'm going to go to Facebook chat. It's more that it's a people-centric design, which I think is what we said back in October when we reviewed it. It's very much based around people rather than based around apps. But the problem with that is that you get a bit lost because everyone's got loads and far more people that they know than they have apps. And also you want to filter through the information that's coming at you, not based on the people it's coming from, but often on the app. So I don't necessarily need to know, you know, Alex, my dear, you know, how your cat has been recently. But
it's
I would
awesome
like to know.
Cats.
Yeah, well, yeah, awesome cats are. But, you know, but I do want to know if we've got a new version of the script. And so you're going to send me something by email about the script, but you're going to send something over Twitter about the cat. I can, you know, make a decision about, well, should I go and read the email or should I go and read the, yeah. So there's, you know, subtleties there, which I think that they're trying to do something different. I'm not necessarily sure that it's quite the right way to go about it. But of course, the fact is that once they start shipping in volume on Nokia, then that's going to make a big difference to the complexion of the smartphone market share.
How much will this relationship affect their stock prices? Simply because it's quite a move, and it's also going to increase their public cash as well, given the number of Nokia handsets that are going to everywhere outside of effectively the Western world.
the thing about Windows Phone and the thing about mobile licenses generally is that they are not big revenue earners. So Microsoft gets about $15, I think, is the estimate, per handset. Compare that to a PC, Microsoft gets about $70 and it makes about $40 profit per PC shipped. So mobiles, not a lot of money in it. And that's been the thing that has held Microsoft back from really being able to figure out a really good way to go into mobile for a long time. So they're looking to do other things with this. They're looking to, can we somehow monetize it by doing Bing? The trouble with the Bing thing, having Bing on the Nokia, and indeed Bing on BlackBerry, which was announced a couple of weeks ago, is what's called the traffic acquisition cost. It's expensive for them to do these deals because RIM is going to say to them, you want us to do Bing on BlackBerry? Fine, give us some money. With Nokia, there's money changing hands. They're going to have to pay Nokia, possibly per search, but there's billions of dollars going from Microsoft to Nokia in this deal. So Bing doesn't become profitable because it's on lots of Nokia handsets at all. Whereas Google gets the benefit that it's on loads and loads of Android handsets because manufacturers are building in for free. They don't have to pay a license to Google, and the Google search is built in. And if they want to be using the Google properties like Google Maps and so on, they have to go through Google. But basically, there's lots of people giving Google its business for free by using the Google search. And Microsoft is having to pay people all over the place. So you can see there's a disparity. So it makes less money on the license, possibly zero profit once you've looked at the sunk costs of all the development, and it's not getting any benefit from the search.
You can read up on all of the Guardian's coverage of Windows Phone 7 at guardian.co.uk/technology. This week, the European Commission implements new rules as part of their digital agenda. These new directives, titled Better Regulation and Citizens' Rights, deal with a series of blanket issues, including supporting a single market, establishing a system for consumer protection, and ensuring network neutrality. Joining me down the line to talk through the new directives and to explain what impact they'll have in the UK is Jonathan Todd, the spokesperson for digital affairs in the EC. Welcome to the podcast, Jonathan. Thank you very much for joining us. Can you just give me a top line on the two directives as they stand and the elements of each?
Yeah, well, essentially, the new rules bring a series of advantages for customers and for operators. For customers, it means that they have the right to switch operators and keep the same number within one working day. It means that they will no longer be tied into long contracts because the initial contract can be no more than 24 months, and they have the right to ask for a contract as short as 12 months. And they are entitled to receive detailed information about the services they're subscribing to. So, for example, they're entitled to know what their connection speeds are, realistic connection speeds, not just as fast as possibly if nobody else is using the internet that day. They're entitled to know whether certain services, like voice over internet, will be blocked or degraded. They also have the right to more protection of their online data. For example, if a cookie is installed on their computer or phone that is not directly related to the services that they are currently accessing, they have to give their consent. Serious breaches of confidentiality, data leaks, have to be notified to the data protection authorities and in very serious cases to the users themselves.
Jonathan, just speak to the issue about cookies just for a moment, because this is something that I think a lot of people are not quite clear about.
Yeah.
The cookies that you're talking about are tracking ones, basically, which would follow you from site to site. You say that they're not for services where they're essential to serve. So, for example, if I'm shopping on Amazon, then where cookies are used to create a shopping basket there, those aren't affected. But the suggestion seems to be that if I'm on a blogger site and a cookie gets landed, then I go to some other Google-owned property there, and the cookie persists, then I need to be told about this. Is that the idea?
Indeed. We recognize that cookies are a very important part of the online experience, but that in those cases where data is being collected without the knowledge of the user and are, for example, being used for behavioral advertising. The user has the right to know and to have to give their consent. It's a bit of a tricky balance because we don't want to interfere too much with the way the internet works, but at the same time, if data is being collected without the knowledge of the user and is being used for purposes that the user might not agree with, then they need to know.
Where, though, is the argument about the behavioral advertising? Because it's not as if they know that when you have a cookie like this, it doesn't know the identity of the person. It's a machine system, isn't it, which sort of says, oh, well, they've been looking at something about cars, now they're looking at something else about, you know, I don't know, gadgets. So even though they're looking at something about gadgets, I'll show them something about cars. Where exactly is the harm in this? Because surely the advertisers would argue that it means that they can spend their money more accurately.
Well, it's not all harmful, which is why it's not forbidden. And it's a question of finding the right balance. But, I mean, let's face it, a lot of services which are free on the internet are financed by advertising.
Well, okay, it's not harmful, then where's the need for regulation? Because this is something which has a lot of sites in the UK exercised, and Ed Vasey, who's the communications minister, has been wrestling with this for months, we understand.
Yeah, well, it's that we want the right balance to be struck, and that there are fears that some of this information is being collected and could be used in a way which is detrimental to the user. And the user needs to be aware of what's happening and why it's happening and have an opportunity to say whether they want it to go ahead or not.
If you look not just at the notion of behavioral advertising and the cookies that are collected on people, which seems to be covered under the Citizens' Rights Directive, the umbrella there, some of the other elements in there are data protection. You mentioned that organizations, if they happen to have a breach of their data protection systems, and they need to reach out to the community and say, yes, this has happened, you know, pretty quickly. What kinds of content falls under this data protection regulation for notification of the breach? Is it just at the billing level, so names and addresses, email addresses, etc.? Or, for example, over in the UK, we've recently had quite a lot of discussion about accessing voicemail being hacked. Does that fall under this directive?
Yes, it would. It's not only billing information, calls made. I mean, it does extend also to the content of what people, you know, for example, voicemails and so on. I mean, it's all essentially meant to act as an incentive for the industry to increase the safeguards that they put in place.
How, though, would the EC recommend that the telecoms operators and the ISPs do this?
Well, it can be encryption, it can be increasing the security of their firewalls. That is up to the operators and the internet service providers. We're not prescriptive.
This seems as well to be the approach that these directives are taking to the notion of net neutrality, to how much an individual state, nation state within the European Union should allow or disallow information to be restricted or opened up to its population. Now, why is this? What happens if, for example, ISPs do decide to charge for access to certain online services? I mean, it could still happen within the rules of the nation state. Why sort of devolve, as it were, this quite important issue?
What the new rules say is that the customer needs to be informed in advance of signing their contract whether there are any restrictions on services they can access, so that they can make an informed choice. And if it means possibly paying more to another internet service provider but being able to save money by using Skype, then they should be able to make that choice on the basis of information that's given to them.
Just on that point you made about being able to swap ISPs if you think that, or you're told that they're blocking, wouldn't you also then need to have the ability, rather like you're bringing in for the phone companies, to be able to switch rapidly and with the minimum of fuss? Because at the moment, a lot of ISPs have 12-month rolling contracts or even longer, and it's very difficult to get switched over. Are you working on something along those lines?
If it became identified as a significant problem, then yes, that is something that we would consider. but it has not been brought to our attention that this is a major problem at the moment.
It's sort of difficult, isn't it, because no one knows at the moment whether services are being blocked. There isn't the transparency to know about, how effective net neutrality is actually being. And surely you'd need the two to be going hand in hand. You'd need the transparency to come along at the same time as you could say to people, well, if you don't like what this ISP is doing, you can switch, rather than have the one follow sometime after the other.
Well, it could follow quite shortly afterwards. What we have said is that we are going to be monitoring very closely the application in practice of these new rules, and that if it becomes apparent that there are major problems as a result, for example, of services being blocked or throttled, then we will come back with guidelines and possibly even new legislation. We've asked the body of European telecoms regulators to work with us in looking at precisely how these new rules are going to be applied in practice. We are encouraging people to get in touch with their telecoms regulator if they have problems, for example, of blocking or throttling, which have not been made transparent beforehand. And we will be reassessing the situation at the end of this year.
Well, thank you very much, Jonathan. And we will have more on these directives and how they will affect us at guardian.co.uk/technology. That's it for another Tech Weekly. Many thanks to Charles Arthur and to Jonathan Todd. The producer this week was Scott Colley. I'm Alex Kratowski. We'll be back next Tuesday. See you then.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.